Jesus is King. Welcome back to the Lay Apostolate on the Meaning of Catholic with my good friend Eric Sammons. Eric, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I, as of this moment, extremely well.
Good.
It's always great to talk with you on or off camera. I've been working with Eric, the so-called dad of Twitter, for a couple years now, since I working much closer with you since I took over 1 Peter 5. And it's just a joy. Like, we have we're on the same page. And importantly, most importantly, we're on the same page about sci-fi. So tell us about your new science fiction novel.
Well, this is my first work of fiction. I wrote a short story of fiction about 10 years ago, but this is my first real book of fiction. Everything else I've written has been nonfiction, and it's a science fiction novel because I love science fiction, always have. And so it basically is set about 100 years in the early 22nd century, and the Vatican rules the world again. They're recovering from an AI revolt, and there's a mysterious signal from outer space that they pick up, and the Pope sends a ship to go investigate. And I'll leave it.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. I can't wait to read it. So this is going to, you said maybe it might be out in October.
I'm hoping October. I'm finishing up a draft right now. Hopefully the final draft. I'm going to have a reviewer look through it. And then I'm also have to, just get formatted and things like that. So I'm hoping October is when it will be out.
Okay, sweet. So it'll be in time for St. Nicholas to bring this to your stocking.
Yes.
Or you can also get his other new book, which is Moral Money. So this series, the Lay Apostolate, this is where we talk about all the lay issues. A lot of people on Catholic Twitter, Catholic Internet, is talking all about clergy issues, aka doctrinal controversies, liturgical controversies, which obviously are very important, but those things are ultimately up for the clergy to resolve those things. And we want them to resolve them ASAP. We don't want them to resolve them yesterday. That's why we talk about them so much as lay people. But as lay people, our domain is the temporal sphere. So this is where our series, Lay Apostles, is where we talk about family, we talk about politics, and we talk about economics. Economics is, it's amazing how important economics is and how difficult it is to understand. And that's why we have this great book from Sammons, because Eric, what you do so well is you take very difficult topics and you make them very, very understandable. And what I love about your book is that it makes one of the most complicated topics, modern finance. It's insane that I can't even understand it myself. I mean, nobody can. That's why we pay financial advisors, right? But you've written this book, which you spend the first like 70 pages just talking about currency basics. That's what I love about it, before you even launch into Bitcoin stuff. So any thoughts on any of that stuff, like economics or simplicity? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is amazing how economically illiterate most people are. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's planned. I think that our government schools, they don't want you to really understand how money works, how economics works, because that keeps them in power. That gives them more power. The more they control money, the more they control the economic system, the more powerful they can be. And so when you start to learn about money, the history of money, how money really works, our monetary system, how it works, you start to realize, hold on a second, this, first of all, is not how it's worked historically. And second of all, it is completely a system that is rigged to prefer the powerful, the rich, the connected, the well-connected, and to basically harm the poor and the middle class and to keep them down. And so really, that's a big part of why I really fell in love with Bitcoin and why I wrote the book, was because, and I realized I can't write a book on Bitcoin and start by talking about Bitcoin. I had to start by talking about, okay, what is money? How does it work? how does our monetary system today work? Why is there serious moral problems with the way our monetary system works? And then I could get into Bitcoin, because that's what I found. I mean, I've been involved with Bitcoin for 12 years now. And so I've talked to lots of people. You know, when the Bitcoin price goes up, everybody comes to me and says, hey, what about this Bitcoin thing? And I realized by the questions I get asked, the objections I get, that often it's not like somebody who's really knows it and understands our monetary system, understands Bitcoin, has an objection, but more like they just don't understand. It's not that they don't understand Bitcoin, because they don't, but they also don't understand our monetary system. So that's what I'm trying to cover all that, which, you know, is a challenge, but I hopefully I succeeded in the book.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you did this, because like a lot of traditionalists, you know, we get really hung up on usury, because usury is it's pretty much the most condemned thing in the history of the church. But with modern finance, it's so complicated that it's much more disputed nowadays whether the XYZ is usury or not. And one of the factors is inflation that I can at least understand, because our money is just losing value. So you have to have some interest in order to just retain the same value. So I just want to go through some of the basic stuff that you have first and have you comment on it before we launch into the Bitcoin. And I found a number of important. So the first chapter is 8 principles of moral money, which you say. So basically, here's the principles. Theft of someone's purchasing power is always condemned. We have a right to the fruit of our labor. Workers should receive a just wage. And economics should have stable currency. That's what I just mentioned. Temperance should be encouraged. Excessive consumption should be discouraged. Parents must be able to provide for their families, and societies should care for the poor. So that's basically like, what is money? What's the point of money? I really like this. And I love how you have all these graphics in the book. Those are really helpful. Yeah. I'm definitely a visual learner, and it's tough for me to understand this stuff. So then you have these other terms, and you bold all the terms in the book, which is really helpful to me too. So you talk about store of value, which is a good that is considered valuable and holds that value over time. Medium of exchange, a good that is obtained not to be consumed or in the product of another good, but primarily exchanged. So that's money.
Right.
Unit of account, the ability to have goods and services priced as units of the money in question. So this is how the barter system becomes a money system. And then here is the other principles here. So the principles of money, or what do you call this, Eric? It's
the properties of money. The
properties, 7 properties of moral money. Okay. Because I like how you're making an argument that money itself, the system itself, can be moral or not, because it tends towards a thing. So these are the 7 principles of moral money. And then I'll have your comment here, Eric. So you say moral money easily is shaped into divisible parts, relatively easy to transport. It's durable. 1 ounce of gold is worth the same as any other ounce. Easy to verify as real, relatively scarce, and not controlled by any one entity. So any comments on the money basics, first of all?
Yeah, so I think that the 7 properties of money, I think one of the most important things to note is that these properties were not determined by some government official, say, okay, let's make some money. And this is what we'll decide. Oh, I like this. This is shiny and yellow. We'll make gold money. That's not how it worked. What happened is that people, as they were exchanging goods, first through a barter system, and then eventually they realized, okay, this is highly inefficient. You have carrots. I have gold. I have cows. I want your carrots. You want my cows. How do we trade for them? And maybe you don't want my cows, but you want something else for your carrots. And so you need to have some third good that everybody recognizes as valuable. Well, if you look at the history of money in mankind, they've tried various things. Seashells have been tried, you know, human teeth have been tried, big rocks have been tried. I list a number of them in the book. But what happened is certain goods actually were just better. They just performed as money better. And because they had these 7 properties, that's what led later economists figured out what the 7 properties were. It wasn't like somebody 1,000 years ago said, what has the 7 properties? It was more just like, hey, this is useful. And gold historically was by far the best form of money. Why? Because it hit those 7 properties. It ranked higher than any other good on all seven of those properties. That's why we have, that's why gold historically has been the top form of money. Silver is also very good in this. Copper is not bad. I mean, it's better than a lot of things. It's not relatively scarce, which is one of the things it's not as good as gold at. So you see, though, that this was all organically done. And this is money basically for the first, 5,000 years of human history or something like that. I mean, throughout human history that we know of, recorded human history, it wasn't until recently, in recent years, the past 100 years in particular, that all of a sudden money started to change in its properties and what mattered. But yeah, so the point though here is that when we're looking at what's a good form of money, we're looking at these seven properties. But here's something I did that I didn't see anybody else do this. When I've read tons of economic books on money and things like that, but I wanted to take it from a different angle, and that's the morality part, which you mentioned. And what I realized, if you look at these seven properties, the first four really have to do with usability, with efficiency, and then the last three really have to do with morality. So the first four, which is divisibility, portability, durability, and fungibility, that's really, I mean, it's not, there's really no moral aspect of those four things. That's more like, okay, is it actually usable as money or not?
Mm-hmm.
But then the last three, verifiability, scarcity, and independence, that really touches moral questions. Because verifiability, for example, if it's very easy to counterfeit a money, well, then people will counterfeit it, which is immoral. If it's not scarce, if somebody can just print their own money, if I have an ability just to, print my own money, create my own money, that's another moral question. And then independence, if a small group of people control the money supply, that raises moral questions. What do they do with that control? And how do they decide how much money's in the system, stuff like that. So really realizing that three of those properties were moral properties is what kind of led me to then realize, okay, we can judge the morality of a form of money. Catholics often say that, everybody says like money's just a tool, it's a neutral tool. On some level, that's true, but it's kind of like you could say the nuclear bomb is just a tool. But clearly, the design of it is such that it will more likely be used for evil than good. It's very difficult to use a nuclear bomb for good, where it's very easy to use it for evil. Likewise with money, different forms of it can be used more easily for evil than other forms of it. And so that's kind of the crux of my argument in the book.
And this brings up a very important sci-fi reference, and that's the Star Wars Expanded Universe, where they find the designer of the Death Star and they lied to her and said they were going to break up rocks and planets with this Death Star thing. And then later she repents and whatnot. So it's just the design of a thing is moral.
Yeah, I mean, just look at it and see what is it. I mean, it's literally, we're calling it the Death Star. What do you think it's going to be used for?
What they called it or not, but yeah. Yeah, yeah. And one of the things I want to point out is like, Eric, is you're kind of on the Austrian spectrum of economics.
Yes.
I would say I'm definitely more on the Heinrich Pesch spectrum of solidarism or whatever, but I'm just such not an Xer that I can't really have a dogmatic opinion. So I'm open to any viewpoint. And this is also by definition, a disputed question among Catholics. So it's absolutely not true for like Catholics to say, oh, well, you're a heretic because you follow Austrian school of economics. That's not true. Can't be said. But one of the criticisms that sort of my school of thought criticizes your school of thought is that the Austrians take economics out of the moral science and they put it into basically the physical science. Like this is just physics. You just set the walls right and then it just works around in a system of gravity and it works perfectly. But what I like about what you're saying is like saying there's an intrinsically moral aspect to this very thing itself, the way that it works. So, and I wanted to point out the one thing that struck me in this list was the easy to verify as real. Because like you said, we had, we had the COVID thing and they just printed out a bunch of money and they threw it at us. And I was like, this is just monopoly money. It's like, you just printed off more money. Where did that come from?
And then, that really gets more to the relatively scarce in my mind. That
oh, okay. But
because like one of the things I distinguish in the book is how is a money produced? And I would say that like there's three different ways. One is basically the laws of nature is like physics in the sense that gold is not produced by man. It's discovered in mind. It's created just as part of nature. And most of them historically have been, say, follow nature, it's physics. And that, at this point, is the
core of. No. Hey, Eric Center, you're up. You're kind of breaking up on my side for some reason.
Oh, okay.
Try again.
Sorry about that.
Okay, now you seem more. Okay, well, try again. Just start over a minute if you can, please. Yeah.
No problem. I was just saying that the three different ways a money can be produced. The first is through like physics, the laws of nature. And that's most historic monies are like that. Gold is not created by man. It's discovered and mined by man. And so that is something, in other words, it's from God. And so it's limited. Man can't just say we're going to have more money because it can't create more gold. They can mine more gold, but they have to spend resources to do that. Fiat money, government money today, that basically just follows the laws of man. In other words, it's arbitrary. Somebody can just hit a button on a computer and say, okay, we have more now. And what we'll see is Bitcoin, it follows a third way, and that's the laws of mathematics. And so it also, and my argument is that Bitcoin also, like gold and other physical forms of money that are bound by the laws of nature and physics, it's bound by the laws of mathematics. And both physics and mathematics point to God, because God is the creator of both of them, whereas fiat money is created solely by man.
Okay, so I want you to give us a breakdown of what fiat money is, because the other thing I saw about this one was, if I understand it correctly, and I don't know if I am, but the fractional reserve lending thing, where I go to the bank, I just open a new account, in fact, because my business, and I deposited money in it, but then the bank doesn't actually have that money, because then, like, I deposit $100 in the bank, and then the bank lends out $300 to other people. Isn't that how it works? They just, like,
yeah, make yeah.
Up
so
money?
Probably the best way to explain fiat money is give a very brief history of how.
Go ahead. Yes.
The money, which was most countries were on a gold standard, and then all of a sudden now we're not. What happened there? And really what it was is that there is one weakness of gold. When you look at the seven properties of money, the number one weakness of gold is portability. It is difficult to, and portability includes like storage and security and all that, basically the physical aspects of, is it easy to actually use it and transfer it? Well, gold actually isn't that easy, especially once you get larger sums. You know, if I want to buy something that costs, you know, a ton of gold or something like that, I have to ship it, I have to secure it, all that stuff. So people realized that. And so what they did was they created a representation of gold, which was typically paper notes. And a bank might do that. So instead of you securing your gold, you holding it, you gave it to a bank, and they would in turn give you paper representing the gold. So you give it, let's say, 100 ounces of gold. They give you paper representing 100 ounces of gold. That way, then when you go to your neighbor and you want to buy something from him, you can just give him a piece of paper representing, let's say, an ounce of gold. And then when he goes to the bank with that, he knows he can get an ounce of gold out for that. And that was a way to overcome probably the biggest weakness of gold as a form of money, was a portability issue. Well, what happened over time is that banks started to realize, wait a minute, we don't actually have to hold all the money that we say we hold, because nobody comes on one day. Like, we're not going to have every single customer of ours come in one day and ask for all their gold. So let's say we have, you know, 1 million ounces of gold in our bank. Well, we're never going to have that many people ask for a million ounces. We might have maybe 100,000 in the craziest day. So what we'll do is we'll take the other 900,000 ounces and we'll use that to make loans, to invest and things like that. We'll make more money off of it. So when you go in and you give them, let's say 100 ounces of your gold, what they're really doing is they're keeping maybe 10 ounces but they're using 90 ounces for something else. It's called fractional reserve banking. Only a fraction of their money is held in reserve. And over time, this gets more and more, you know, happened. But then what happened as well is, and this particular, this happened before this, but this is when it really came to be, was in early 20th century, particularly World War One, as you know, the cause of many of our political problems today. You can be dated back to World War One and everything surrounding that. Well, what happened was, is like these countries go in this global conflict that was, that really none of them should have been involved with. I mean, as you know, the history of World War One, it's just insane that England is involved in this conflict, for example, and Russia, and, but they had to because of treaties and whatnot. Well, it's very deeply unpopular. So they need money though. And traditionally the way kings and rulers would get money for a war is they tax the people. They knew there was a limit to that though. If it was a hugely unpopular war, they couldn't, you know, they might not get their taxes. But here we had a situation where the government said, wait a minute, you know what we could do? We can just have paper money that doesn't actually represent gold in the bank, or even the fractional part of the gold in the bank. We'll just say it's worth it because people have been using paper for so long. In the mind and the psychological kind of feeling of the average person, when he holds a dollar that says this represents, on in the fine print, this represents $1 of gold at the bank, he doesn't actually think of the gold anymore. He's just like, the dollar is the money. It's not a representation of the money. It is the money. And governments took advantage of that. And so what happened was, from the time of World War One till about the time of 1971, 1970s, essentially, there was this transfer, this transformation of money from being backed by a physical item, a law, something bound by the laws of nature, by physics. And instead, it was now just simply backed by the fact the government had created it. And so by the 1970s, in basically every country, the United States, of course, being the leader in all this, and Nixon, when he famously temporarily, got off the gold standard in 1971, basically what they said was, okay, the dollar bill is simply a piece of paper that represents a dollar bill because we say it does. And that's, now we've transformed into what's called fiat money. Fiat, of course, us Catholics, we immediately think of Our Lady's fiat, be it done to me according to thy word. But this is more the idea of fiat, let it be. In other words, the government says, let this be equal to $1. Because why? Because we said so. And so that becomes, now you have not only fractional reserve banking, which has gotten much worse in my example, because now when you deposit $1,000 in the bank, they can literally create $10,000 out of that. And I go in the book how that happens, but it's like, it just is all funny money. It's all, and I don't, for me, one of the biggest challenges I have is, as a Catholic, I wish and I hope that one day the church would address this, because you never hear the evils of fiat money ever addressed in church documents. But to me, the idea that a bank is given $1,000 and then they magically create $10,000 out of that, that they pump into the economy, I don't see how that's not immoral. To me, that seems to be deeply immoral. But then you also have now, in addition to fractional reserve banking, you have just a system of where a government official can just simply say, okay, we need more money in the system. This is what they did in 2008. They've done this for years, but 2008 was a great example where they did the quantitative easing, which was basically, and what they do is they do all these fancy different steps. I always get them confused myself. I read them like, oh, okay. And then the next day I forget the details. But the point is they printed more money. They just injected the economy with billions and trillions more dollars. And what that does is it devalues your purchasing power. Remember how I said one of the top moral properties of money was you can't steal somebody's purchasing power. Note how I worded that. Obviously, when we talk about the commandments, is thou shalt not steal. When you're talking about stealing money, what are you really stealing? It's not that you're stealing paper or coins or digital representation. You're stealing purchasing power. So I'm a dad. I have kids. I'm supporting them. And all of a sudden, I have $1,000. You take $1,000 and you steal it from me. Well, what you've really stolen is my ability to buy $1,000 worth of goods for my family. You know, pay my mortgage, to buy food, to buy clothes, whatever the case may be. That's what you're really stealing. That's the immoral part of it. Well, what if I have $1,000 and the government does something to make that $1,000 now worth $800. Well, they've stolen $200 of purchasing power from me, just as much as if they had come in and literally taken $200 away from me. They've decreased my ability to support my family. To me, that's a direct moral issue. Then it does touch upon the command, thou shalt not steal. And so what we see with fiat money is I think it's just foundations are deeply immoral, because now we have a system where by creating new money out of thin air, we decrease the purchasing power of the money that you own. And I think that's something we have to recognize, because if you have, let's say $1 million floating in an economy, well, things are priced accordingly. Well, let's say somebody shows up and they just dump $1 billion in. Well, now all of a sudden everything gets more expensive because there's $1 billion sloshing around in the economy. But let's say you're not one of the people who got that $1 billion, part of $1 billion. Now all of a sudden you have all these higher prices you have to pay, but you're not any better off really because of it. So that's really kind of touches the real moral problems with fiat money.
Yeah, it seems that fiat money is referring to fiat lux, let there be light, in Genesis 1:1, like creating something out of nothing. Because it does seem like they are literally trying to create something out of nothing, because the math doesn't add up.
I would say that like fractional reserve banking is a form of fiat money, because it's creating something out of nothing, money out of nothing. But obviously fiat money itself, government issued money itself, which isn't backed by anything other than trust me, bro, that is the platonic ideal of fiat money, because it's literally saying we're just going to create money out of nothing.
Yeah. So all the properties of real money is that you have to do something. You have to put in something to get it. Like you got to mine gold. You have to whatever. So let me get to the questions from our guild community. Our guild community at Meaning of Catholic is an international community of Catholics supporting one another against the Marxists and the fiat currency people as well. So just trying to see how we can support each other, but we can in this crazy world post-COVID tyranny. Liam says this, which is exactly what we're trying to say. So let's talk about Bitcoin. Liam says, how are Bitcoins created? Can they just disappear? Gold and land have tangible value. Can we say the same for Bitcoin?
Yeah, and that really is the crux of the issue for most Catholics I encounter, because there is the barrier to entry, so to speak, of as Catholics, we're very incarnational. We touch things, we have sacraments that we can touch and feel and things like that. Our Lord became physical, flesh, he became man for our salvation. And so I understand that. Bitcoin, though, like I said, it's bound by the rules of mathematics. So what happened was when Bitcoin was created back in 2009, it was a computer program set up, what's called a computer protocol, a software protocol, which is basically the rules for how it would work. Just like email, there's an email protocol for how email works. There's an internet protocol for TCP, IP, how the internet works. So this was a Bitcoin protocol that basically fixed how new Bitcoin is created and how much would be created and when it would be created. And so what the inventor of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, that's his pseudonym. We don't know who it actually was. He created a schedule so that 21 million Bitcoin would be created, and that would be it. And the way he did it, he did the most was created early on, and it's decreasing over time. So basically, every 10 minutes at the beginning, 50 new Bitcoin were created. And this was done through a process called mining, which, like you just said, it involves effort and time. Computer time in this case, and right now it's extremely expensive to mine for Bitcoin because it's very valuable, and so people spend a lot of money to do it. But basically every 10 minutes, 50 new Bitcoin are created. After 4 years, that dropped to 25 new Bitcoin. After four more years, 12 and a half. Then it's called the halving. Every 4 years, approximately half as many Bitcoin are created every 10 minutes as before. Right now we're on a cycle where 3.125 Bitcoin are created every 10 minutes. And over time, basically 21 million Bitcoin be created. Almost 20 million have already been created. So most of them have already been created. And there's no way to create new Bitcoin except for through this process. In other words, you have to spend time and energy. You have to, you have to build the server, plug it in, spend the money on the energy. All that stuff needs to happen in order to potentially mine new Bitcoin.
So it's basically some kind of computer programming, something or other, that is a mining process that creates this digital currency.
Yes. And mining really does two things. It both creates new Bitcoin but it also, it secures the network. And the more people are, and I won't get into technical issues of that, how that works, but basically the more money spent on mining, the more secure Bitcoin is, the more difficult it is to counterfeit. So basically, I mean, it would take, I mean, more money than anybody had, than the US government has even probably at this point to actually try to hack the mining system so that you create new counterfeit Bitcoin or something like that. I mean, just it's astronomical. It's literally the most powerful computer system in the world is the Bitcoin network. And so what it's doing though is basically though, this is all a decentralized process because remember I said it has to be independent as well to be moral. There is no CEO of Bitcoin Corporation or anything like that. Basically what happens is like, just like I use the analogy in the book. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think it helps people understand. Think about email for a moment. Who runs email? It's not Google with Gmail. It's not Microsoft with Hotmail or whatever. It's literally just a computer program called a software protocol that runs on servers throughout the world. So for example, if Google went down tomorrow and Gmail was down, your Gmail account wouldn't work, but that doesn't mean email doesn't work. People using Hotmail or Yahoo or whatever, it continues to work. Why? Because they're all plugged into this protocol that they all basically agree to. We have to follow these rules to send email. And so, but nobody owns the email protocol. Nobody runs it. It's just a bunch of people, you know, thousands of people, millions of people probably at this point around the world have servers to run. Bitcoin's the same way. You have these Bitcoin nodes. I actually have one running in my house because it's free to run. You can run it on an old laptop if you want to. And what it does is it runs that Bitcoin protocol software. And it then, and it basically is just, it's what's checking the network to say, okay, are these transactions, is this legitimate transaction? If it is, send it through, otherwise don't. And right now there's over 20,000 Bitcoin nodes around the world. Governments have tried to shut down Bitcoin. For example, China has a few times, I think Russia did once, tried to once. But the problem is like, because it's global and it's just individuals running it, it's basically impossible to shut down because if America tomorrow shut down the Bitcoin network, I may or may not shut down my Bitcoin node. But like, that doesn't mean some dude in Russia or in England's going to shut down theirs. In fact, what usually happens is more people start running it outside of that country. When China at one point actually made Bitcoin mining illegal, and that's where most of the mining was done at this time. I mean, it was like the most of the miners were in China because they had cheap energy they could access. Well, as soon as they made it illegal, you know what happened? The Bitcoin network was fine because most miners went to Texas because in Texas, they were able to get deals to get cheap energy there. And so if Texas all of a sudden tomorrow said we're going to ban Bitcoin mining, it'll move somewhere else where it's cheaper. So that's just how the economics of it works.
So the communists hate it. So that's all you need to know right there. The Chinese communists hate
it. Oh, they definitely hate it.
Therefore, it's good. Whatever the Chinese communists hate is a good thing. Okay, so Christian says, I would like to know how Samids would address Bitcoin with his son when he taught him about saving and not getting into debt, something he touched on in a video about personal finances a while ago. How would you tell this to your son?
I actually did do this. My son is now 22, I think, and I introduced him to Bitcoin soon after I got introduced to it because he was interested. So he was probably, that was 12. Yeah, he was like 10 years old or something like that, 10, 11. And honestly, one of the things I love about Bitcoin, and I've seen it in practice with people, even people who are not Catholic, not Christian, is that it really does emphasize savings. It emphasizes a temperate, non-consumerist lifestyle. And the reason for that is because Bitcoin keeps its value. It's a store of value. Like gold is, it's actually been better in gold over its history, but still, like gold, it's a store of value. Here's the thing. If I have $1,000 today, and I tell you in a year, it's going to be worth $800, you're going to be more incentivized to spend it now rather than later because the value of it's going down. If I give you $1,000 today, and I say, in a year, it's going to be worth $1,200.
Right.
You're more incentivized to save it rather than spend it because it's going to be worth more in the future. Now, you're still going to buy things you need. You're still going to buy your food, your clothing, your housing, all that stuff. And you might even take a vacation or something like that. It's not like you're going to stop spending money. But the fact is because it's basically deflationary, it's going up in value, in other words, then what happens is that you're more likely to save. And so Bitcoin is a perfect way that I was able to teach my own kids the importance of temperance, you know, and not embracing consumerism and saving money rather than spending. Because if you know that your Bitcoin that you're using for your savings account, it's going to go up in value later, you're really going to do everything you can not to spend it unless you actually think, yeah, I actually need this. This is something I need. You're not going to buy some trinket that you see that dangles in front of you at Amazon or something like that. In fact, I have an app on my computer that translates all dollar figures into Satoshis, which is the lowest unit of account for Bitcoin. So it tells me how much it is cost in Bitcoin. That reminds me, do I really want this? Because if I just hold it in Bitcoin, it's probably going to be worth, my Bitcoin's going to be worth more in the future instead of whatever this dumb thing is I'm looking at to buy. So I thought Bitcoin was a great way to teach my own son and my daughters about savings because it is built for savings, unlike fiat, which is literally, and this is the intention of it, built for spending.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So there's so much more I want to ask you, but I'm going to give the guild members more time. So Craig says this, it seems to be that all cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, slowly centralize over time due to partly to the way mining algorithms work, where fewer and fewer people are capable of the process power needed. So total value centralizes over time to only a privileged few, opening their markets to massive manipulation. So in lieu of this phenomenon, do these digital currencies really have upside over fiat?
Okay, so that's an awesome question. And one thing I want to do is distinguish between Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Most people lump them all together, but I would claim that they are wrong to do so. I think that Bitcoin is a difference in kind from other cryptocurrencies. Yes, Bitcoin is the first cryptocurrency. That's where we get the term from because it used cryptography for security and it's a currency. But other cryptocurrencies are basically copies of Bitcoin on some level, at least if not a actual code copy, then a idea copy. But they all have basically founders, people who run them and still control them. And that's very centralizing. Bitcoin, because it was founded by a guy named Satoshi Nakamoto, whom we don't even know who it is, and he hasn't been involved in the project since 2011, he has literally no control over it anymore. It's much more of a decentralized entity that really does act as decentralized. So as far as like, because there's two aspects I think that he's asking about. One is the mining, which is an important point. But the other part is like the development of the code and things like that. A lot of cryptocurrencies, other than Bitcoin, they like to tout their ability to update and make changes. Because that's what we think of when we think of software, right? Your iPhone. Hey, the latest iPhone has these new gizmos and features. How great it is. Well, most cryptocurrencies, that's how they market themselves. Hey, we have this new feature now. We can do this. We can do this better in Bitcoin. We can do all this. That's actually terrible for money. You don't want money that's easily upgradable, that's easily changed. That's the problem with fiat. I mean, gold has literally been the same for 6,000 years. And that's a good thing. That's what you want your money to be because that's what keeps the store of value. What if some developer says, I'm going to create this cryptocurrency. I'm going to create this new feature. And he introduces a bug with his new feature. That's the last thing you want with a money. Bitcoin, however, because of the way it's the community works and the way it all works, it's extremely difficult to actually make any changes to it. And that's good for money. So there's been actually battles in the history of Bitcoin of trying to change it that have failed. They've kind of proven this out. There's a huge battle in 2017 in which they tried to change how certain aspects of how Bitcoin worked. Very powerful people who were very high up in the Bitcoin community were trying to get this change pushed through, and they failed. And that was the funny thing is I was on the wrong side back then because I didn't quite understand as well as I do now. But that was great because it showed, okay, Bitcoin can't easily be changed. So that shows how decentralized it is, unlike other cryptocurrencies. But then the mining, there have been times in which mining has become more or less centralized, but it's not true anymore. Because really what's happened is there's been so many advancements in technology and just the way and being able to access energy and things like that, that really Bitcoin mining is no longer centralized. And like I said, it was getting centralized in China. Like there was like basically, I think it was like four different companies were doing more than 50% of the mining and they were all Chinese companies. And that was, everybody's like, uh-oh. But then China ended up banning Bitcoin mining and solved the problem for everybody. Cause then dispersed around the world, especially in Texas. But yeah, Bitcoin mining is not as centralized as it used to be. And it really isn't centralized. And there's nobody can kind of take over the mining industry. You couldn't get like a billionaire Elon to say, okay, I'm just going to take over Bitcoin mining. Even Elon doesn't have the money to do that.
Interesting. Okay, even Elon. All right, so here's Andrew is a financial advisor in our guild community, and he has this question. I'll get two questions for Andrew, and then I have one more question. He says this, wouldn't it be a better conclusion to compare Bitcoin to gold, a store of value, versus the US dollar, especially because gold used to back the dollar? And secondly, hardly anyone uses Bitcoin in daily commerce, same as gold. Is it fair to say Bitcoin is digital gold?
The answer is yes. And that's in fact, a common phrase used by Bitcoiners is calling it digital gold. I would have a couple caveats. The first is I would actually argue Bitcoin is better than gold. And that's my controversial statement probably for the trad crowd. And the reason for that is number one, it's better than gold. Remember, go back to the seven properties. It's better than gold because of portability. It's extremely portable. I could literally send $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, which I don't have, just so people know, $1 billion worth of Bitcoin to somebody in Japan and it would get to them and be completely finalized, settled within 10 minutes. And that's just impossible. It's impossible with fiat, actually, because that much money you'd have to have, you know, you have all the banks involved and governments and stuff like that. But in gold, you can't do that. Because if you want to send $1 billion of gold to somebody around the world, that takes a lot of effort to do that. It would literally be a couple clicks of the button with Bitcoin. So it's more portable. It's also more scarce than gold. And that, remember, was a moral property. Gold is one of the most scarce forms of money there is, but we can always find more gold if we spend enough money. And there's even talk, going back to science fiction, that there's gold on asteroids that we could potentially one day mine and get a whole and really flood the market with more gold. So it's not as scarce as Bitcoin, which has a fixed upper limit. There's never been a form of money that had a 100% fixed upper limit. So I'd say it's better than gold, but yes, it's very much like gold. Here's where I would maybe differ perhaps with the gentleman who asked the question, is that I would say that Bitcoin, if you look at the purposes of money, you have number one, store of value. Number two, medium of exchange. Number three, unit of account. I would say historically, that is a progression that a money goes through. It has to be valued before anybody is going to exchange anything for it. So first, it's a store of value. Second, it becomes a medium of exchange. Everybody starts valuing it. They're like, hey, I'll give you Bitcoin for that. Oh, I'll take Bitcoin for that. Then finally, enough people use it that it becomes a unit of account where you price everything in that form of money, in Bitcoin in that case. Right now, Bitcoin, remember, is 16 years old. It's relatively new compared to gold. It's like a barely even out of the womb. And in that time, though, it's basically coalesced as a store of value. It's in that phase. Yes, it is used in medium exchange in some places. My website, you can buy my book, Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin, with Bitcoin at ericsammons.com. So like you can go to Steak and Shake and use Bitcoin. You can, if you want to contact Jeff Bezos and get a flight to space, going back to our sci-fi love, you can do that with Bitcoin if you have enough money in Bitcoin. So it is slowly becoming more and more a medium exchange because more people are valuing it. This is, I think this is like the natural progression. This is what we'd expect. In fact, I think it's moving a little faster than we expect as far as medium exchange. Yes. It's a tiny percentage of people accept Bitcoin, but it's bigger than it was 10 years ago and it's growing. And so what happens is as more and more people value as a store of value, they will use it as a medium exchange. And so, and then eventually my hope is we get on a Bitcoin standard where it becomes the form of money and then it becomes a unit account. When you go to Amazon, it tells you how many Satoshis something is worth, and that's what you pay with. So that's how I see it as, yes, it is very much like gold now, but eventually it will become more and more a true currency, a form of money that's used by people.
Okay. Thank you so much, Eric. This is fascinating. So I'm just going to put this on the screen. So this is Andrew again, the financial advisor. He says this, the government is recognizing Bitcoin as a viable asset. Best example is a mortgage applications are now recognizing Bitcoin as a measurable asset. However, it is also being taxed as an asset too, capital gains. I don't even know what it means by that because I'm not good.
I'll explain it.
Currencies do not get taxed, but assets do. At the end of the day, isn't the government entitling itself to the long-term appreciation anyhow? Whether it is a liquid or illiquid asset, also don't know what that means, the government is repatriating back into its own balance sheet, right? And we have a balance sheet. Lots of terms here that are going over my head. So Can you break down what is he asking and then answer?
Yeah. It's a great question. Obviously, he knows his stuff. I mean, this, what was his name? Andrew, was it?
Yeah, Andrew, just so everybody knows, I will advertise him as a financial Catholic financial advisor as well. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, obviously he knows his stuff. Okay, so first of all, what he's talking about is that typically in the tax code, you have things are either a currency or there may be a what's called a commodity or a capital good. And so, for example, when you buy something with money, you don't get taxed. The money itself, the thing you're using doesn't get taxed. But if you sell something, if I sell, for example, if I have gold, let's say I buy gold at $1,000 an ounce, and in a year I sell it for $2,000 an ounce. I made $1,000 on that. That $1,000 is taxed. That's called capital gains. There was a gain on your capital. There's also, you can have a capital loss as well if you sell it for a loss. Bitcoin is treated like that today, just like gold. So if I buy Bitcoin, let's say I buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, and then I use it for something. Maybe I buy, you know, buy something for that's worth $2,000 in a year with that same amount of Bitcoin. So I had a $1,000 capital gain on that. I have to pay taxes on that. I have had many discussions with my accountant to make sure we get that all clear. In fact, I usually, if I'm not 100% sure what my basis is, which is what I bought it at, I always just go down to almost zero because I'll pay more taxes rather than get in trouble with the tax man. But the point of this is that what he's saying is it's not really acting as a currency. The government doesn't treat it as a currency. And he's absolutely right. Again, I would go back to my previous answer, which is we're still in the evolution, the creation of Bitcoin as a real form of money. So right now it's absolutely, it is considered like an asset, not as a currency for tax reasons. And so that's a real problem in that if you want to use Bitcoin to buy something, you do have to consider the tax consequences. Now, there already are bills in place that they're trying to work through Congress to make it so that, for example, I think one says anything under $600, you don't pay capital gains tax on. In other words, it would be much more like a currency. So if I bought $100 worth of something with Bitcoin, I don't have to worry about the taxes on it. So yeah, right now, in fact, I would argue that the capital gains tax on Bitcoin is probably the biggest barrier, the greatest barrier to money, to Bitcoin becoming a true usable money and currency because of the tax consequences of any time you convert it from Bitcoin into dollars. So it's a great question. And right now, yes, I just think what will happen is as Bitcoin becomes more and more popular and more powerful people use it, they will start to lessen those restrictions on those capital gains taxes on Bitcoin.
Okay, that's a fascinating aspect to it, because I mean, one of the most attractive things to me is the fact that we don't have all of the tyrannous governments that, I mean, it's pretty much every single government is a tyranny nowadays, yes, as far as I'm concerned. So, I mean, we just had like, with COVID, we had, another communist country, Canada, was seizing bank accounts just like that. Yeah. Boom, just seize your bank account. That's why I'm like, this is just monopoly money. It's just a bunch of numbers. It's not real. They can just take it away if they want, or it just evaporates in terms of value. So let me get our last question. This is from Katarina from the Philippines. And she says this, hold on, let me close this. Hold on, I have a guest commentator who's just entered the room. So just a minute. What's up, Peanut?
Hi.
First of all, you have to say hi to Mr. Sammons.
Hi.
Hello, right. Sweetie. How are you?
What's up, Peanut? What do you need? Let's mark the times. We can edit this part out. Let's see.
This might be the best part people want to watch.
49 minutes. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yes, she always steals the show. I'll be right back. What's up, Peanut? Okay. 50 minutes, 30 seconds. Okay. Okay. So final question from Katarina from the Philippines. She says this, does Salmon still think cryptocurrencies are good and not anti-Bitcoin? She says this, I watched some of his podcasts on Bitcoin where he clumped it with other cryptocurrencies. At the same time, he also talked about Bitcoin maximalists those who believe that only Bitcoin is honest, and he said he was slowly getting there. So I'm wondering if he's already there and if he can explain why or why not. To add more context to this, Bitcoin is unique because unlike all other cryptocurrencies, its blockchain cannot be changed, which you've kind of gotten into that. Well, strictly speaking, theoretically, it can be changed, but to do so would require tremendous amounts of energy, which even a combination of nation states don't have. In addition, changing it would require rolling back the blockchain already recorded. And to roll this back, aside from the tremendous amount of energy required, it would also require time. And at this point in the Bitcoin blockchain's life, it would probably take thousands of years to do so. When it does, the loot would be worthless. So in effect, it is impossible to change the Bitcoin blockchain. Anyone who claims to have done it at some point in the future would be peddling a different blockchain, which would certainly not be Bitcoin. But all other cryptocurrencies can be changed at will by anyone. All other cryptocurrencies are digital fiat currencies. Worse, since the absence of government regulations, and I'm not peddling intervention, makes scamming very easy. Not that, and that's the other thing, because I mean, I'm always getting these Bitcoin scammy things, you know, right? Not that fiat currency don't scam us every day anyway, since the very framework by which fiat exists and operates is a Ponzi. So can you explain, she uses the term Bitcoin blockchain. Is that just the system of Bitcoin? Is that what she's saying?
Blockchain is basically the term for the underlying technology that is a public ledger. That's how Bitcoin works, is like every transaction is on a public ledger that these different Bitcoin nodes all sync and coordinate with. Okay. And it's just called blockchain. It's the name comes from the technical aspects of how it works. This is somewhat of an inside baseball question for Bitcoiners, but I don't mind because I understand it. But also, I kind of addressed it earlier with what I was saying. I have changed over time into what's called a Bitcoin maximalist.
Okay.
What that means is, like, it's a debate inside the cryptocurrency world. Is Bitcoin fundamentally different than all the other cryptocurrencies that have been created? For a long time, I said no. In fact, I was a leader of a alternative cryptocurrency for a number of years. I was one of their top people who really promoted it and was on the kind of the committee that helped run it and all that stuff, make decisions. And so, but over time, I kind of realized that I was wrong and that Bitcoin is fundamentally different, as I mentioned before. And there's a number of reasons for that. But I would also say that I'm a little bit different than some Bitcoin maximalists would say. Bitcoin is the only true cryptocurrency. Every other one is a scam. I don't think that. I think really, and there's millions of other cryptocurrencies at this point. I would simply say Bitcoin is a form of money. All other cryptocurrencies are essentially tech projects. So just like you would evaluate a tech company, a stock of a tech company, to say, okay, do they have a history of doing a good job? Are they delivering what they say they are? Are they potentially defrauding us? Are they, you know, all this stuff. You would judge a tech company based on that. If you're judging Apple or Microsoft or whatever. With other cryptocurrencies, you do the same. You would say, okay, this cryptocurrency claims it can do this. Is that true? Is that possible? Would it actually work the way they say they would? Do I trust the people who are running it? Because that's the other difference. Bitcoin is run by nobody, whereas these cryptocurrencies always have somebody who's basically controlling the network, controlling the production of coins, controlling the features they'll have, stuff like that. And so I would say of the other millions of cryptocurrencies, 99.9 are either scams or just failed projects. I mean, that's the one I worked on was not a scam, but it was a failed project. Eventually I realized, okay, it's not going to do what it claims it's going to do. It actually tried to claim to be a form of money and it can't be because Bitcoin is. And so I do think there's a few projects that perhaps might be successful in some small arena or something like that, not as a form of money, but more as like a computer program or a software product or something like that. So I'm not going to just say they're all scams. But at the same time, I personally, you know, this podcast is not financial advice, whatever the disclaimer you need. I personally no longer, I used to hold some of these other cryptocurrencies for a number of years. I did. I don't anymore. I only hold Bitcoin. It's the only form of cryptocurrency I hold now. So basically, your reader is a Bitcoin maximalist, I gather, and I am with her.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, this has been so fascinating. I just want to real quick shout out to our friend Andrew Marusik. So this is him right here. You can look him up. Solid Catholic financial advisor. If you have big, huge questions and want to get into that with a financial advisor, you can look up Andrew Marusik at MaiCapital, MAI.capital. He's a great guy, member of our guild community.
I just want to note, I don't, of course, know Andrew at all, and this is the first I'm hearing him, but his questions actually, one of the things that's funny in the Bitcoin world is like we often almost mock financial advisors because they don't even know what to ask about Bitcoin. They're so like, there's so much in the fiat world, they clearly don't even know. Whereas I could just tell by his questions that he's not one of them. he understands actually, okay, his questions made clear. He understands what Bitcoin is and how it works.
Okay.
At least on a basic level. And whereas a lot of financial advisors, frankly, they don't, they're ignorant, but they think they know everything. And Andrew was the exact opposite.
Sweet. Okay. Yeah. So everybody look up Andrew. You could reach out to him for a financial advisor from Catholic View. And make sure that you pick up a copy of Moral Money. Click the link below. This is, it's so, even if you disagree with everything Sam has just said, just interacting with this whole frame of reference and everything, I think is so important. It's like one of the most important parts of economics, as far as I can tell, but it's so difficult to understand. So I'm excited to delve deeper into your book. So thanks, Eric, for writing this. And let's pray an Ave, because we'll pray Hail Mary, because we need some help in our fiat world. Where everybody's, we're not only fiating currency, but we're fiating girls into boys and boys and girls and God knows what else. So it's a good thing Jesus is on the throne. So let's pray a Hail Mary. In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace. The Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And I just I forgot to mention, Pope Leo has asked everyone to fast today that God may turn away his wrath and end all these wars going on. So make sure that you fast. Please fast. Maybe you forgot. Maybe you just heard about it just now. Well, you could offer up tomorrow. Fast. Offer up some kind of fast, because we know that war is the wrath of God and war is hell. And we have our brethren who are suffering all over the world, especially in Ukraine and Israel. And everyone suffering in these wars need to end. And I know Sam is very much, we're both on the same page, very anti-war. Yeah. This is terrible. Absolutely. So please offer up a fast. Do what you can for this cause of peace. All right. God bless, everybody.